Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasslash, episode 255 for August 29th. Plug-ins, spin loss, and powertrains of the future.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Good evening. As you'll notice, John's not here, so I'm sitting in for him. And so, you know, we've had a lot of shows here with a lot of smart people, and I think that the level of the IQ is probably higher than we've had in quite some time. So let me introduce to you first Stephanie Brindley. She's an analyst with IHS Automotive. Stephanie,
hello.
How are
hello,
you doing?
Everybody. I'm terrific. Good. Thanks for having me today.
We have Gary Witzenberg of Automedia.com, and Gary also happens to be a freelance writer, and as we'll learn during the course of this discussion, has a certain expertise in things about electrification. And we have a very special guest. Now, this is incredible. This is Larry Nitz. He's GM Powertrain Executive Director, Global Transmissions and Electrification. And this he holds 41 U.S. patents. He's got 4 Boss Kettering Awards from General Motors for engineering innovation. So these are special awards that are given out to people who are just excessively brilliant in terms of things they do. He's got a Bachelor of Science from Kettering University and in electrical engineering, and a Bachelor of Science, Master
there you go.
Of Science from Stanford University.
Right.
And I can't understand how you went to Stanford University and then came back to Michigan. This just seems inconceivable to me because that's the most beautiful campus on earth. He's been involved in every major GM electrification technology project, EV1, two-mode hybrid powertrain, Saturn VU, battery alternator starter, eAssist, Spark EV, Cadillac ELR, Volt. Did I leave anything out?
Got it. I think that's it.
That's it.
Glad to be here.
So what are you up to that you can talk about?
Well, there's all kinds of great and exciting things that we continue to work on at GM in the electrification space and in transmissions, too.
That's right, the new 8-speed transmission.
That's right, the new 8-speed that we just introduced in the Corvette Stingray. Mm-hmm. We're really excited about that. It's extremely smooth, quick, precise, wonderful, shifting, automatic. In fact, it... some say the true enthusiasts like the manuals, but the automatic will actually out-accelerate the manuals now.
Mm-hmm.
So really excited about that work.
Yeah, so Gary and I, maybe, Stephanie, did you have a chance to drive it last week?
I did.
Last week we drove it, yeah.
I love the car, and the new 8-speed makes it even better. It really does,
mm-hmm.
both for fuel economy and for performance and for drivability all mm-hmm. around.
Right. We've integrated a number of different modes into that. There's sport mode and... track mode, really exciting modes that a customer can play around with, paddle shifting, super fast paddle shifting, and it's just a all-around fantastic experience for our Corvette owners.
And then plus there's the whole issue that you guys had to do some very clever work in terms of packaging because you wanted to make the package for the new 8-speed transmission to be the same size as the package for the 6-speed transmissions.
Right, right. So how do you innovate your way into more in the same box, mm-hmm. so to speak? And we have computer solvers that come up with different ideas on how we hook up gears and shafting to make it all work. And one of the outcomes of that computer solver was this arrangement. And so we worked through the possibility, could this package and fit and everything else? And in fact, it could. And so we went on the mission to get that done on time for the Corvette Z06 and Stingray, and it's just a terrific device now.
So speaking about things like transmissions, I mean, How do you decide whether you're going to be doing a development internally or say, okay, we're going to go to a company like ZF or someone else to provide transmissions?
Well, we make and buy transmissions, largely make, for cost efficiencies. We are one of the largest transmission producers in the world, largest gear producer in the world, I think, by most standards. And so we have a big infrastructure of building high-quality, cost-effective automatic transmissions. And as we look to the future, we look at different arrangements and decide, do we want to build this one or do we want to buy it? We tend to buy our niche products, and we tend to build our core products.
Okay, but Corvette seems sort of nichey to me.
Yeah, but the 8-speed will be used beyond the Corvette. We already announced it'll be used in our full-size trucks coming up this year. And so we're real excited about how we can build a family of products, too. We don't just build one for one specific application. We'll build a family that use the same control system, the same mechanical arrangement, maybe packaged in, you know, small, medium, and large, and have different parts inside to flex for the specific applications.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And why the number 8? Why not 7? Why not 9? I mean, is there some magic there?
You know, I was in the transmission business before I ever got into electrification, and I can remember going from 3 to 4, and I can remember the studies that we did and said 6 is all you could ever possibly need, and diminishing returns beyond 6. But it comes down to, can you package more gears, get more efficiency, more performance, and low spin losses? Spin losses are super critical. When you're taking the power from the engine and delivering it to the road, spin losses matter a lot. They're one of the biggest elements in achieving great fuel economy. So we can have and create, you know, 8, 9, 10, 12 speed transmissions, but the key is to do that cost effectively and with low spin losses.
Mm-hmm.
And so our 8-speed is an arrangement that we like real well because of its low spin losses.
Mm-hmm.
On the Corvette, we're almost 5% better fuel economy than the 6-speed just for the transmission. So it's pretty amazing.
It's a big hit there in terms of what you're able to achieve through that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Anybody?
Was it, if we're talking transmissions, how much of a challenge was it to get it to take all the torque of a Z06 coming up, for example?
Yeah, 650 pound-feet of torque, 650 horsepower. Pretty exciting ride by any standard. And you're right. These are planetary automatic transmissions, which typically can carry torque very effectively, very cost-effectively and space-effectively. But packaging 8 gears, 8 speeds, with the clutches needed to do that and have them synchronized properly, really becomes a controls challenge. It's a packaging challenge and a controls challenge. And the controls have to deliver that super smooth shifting, super fast, super refined shifting that you talked about, Gary.
Are there significant differences between the Corvette application and especially Z06 and then the truck application?
There's packaging differences. The transmission in the Corvette is driven by a torque tube, and it's physically located in the rear of the car, where the truck is obviously a conventional engine transmission arrangement. But the inside of the transmission, there's a lot of commonality. And the controls and how we do the basic work of shifting is pretty much the same.
Okay.
So we have a question from the chat room, George from Sunnyvale, which is not far from Stanford.
That's right, George.
So why has GM not embraced dual-clutch transmissions, and when will the new 10-speed automatics become available? So the 10-speed is the one you're working on with Ford.
That's right.
Okay. So DCTs.
Well, I can't talk about the 10-speeds, but we did engineer our own DCT, and we're launching it soon in China. It was announced maybe your mid-year this year, I think in about June, with our Chinese partner. And so there will be press events soon in China, and then the launch of a new vehicle in China with that
So what's DCT? The advantage of a DCT versus a step gear transmission that we're more familiar with?
Well, a DCT, think of it as kinematically like a manual transmission. But it's set up that one clutch does say 1, 3, 5, 7, and another clutch controls 2, 4, 6, and maybe reverse. And you can set them up in 5-speed, 6-speed, 7-speed, forward in, one in reverse arrangements. This particular DCT that we've done is a 7-speed, forward and one in reverse. DCTs have good fuel economy, low spin losses as well. Spin loss is super important. But we've been able to also make our planetary automatic transmissions have almost the same spin losses as a DCT. And fundamentally, we have a big infrastructure to build them cost effectively. So we're going to do both.
Wasn't the DCT a packaging challenge for Corvette, though? It would have to have been larger.
Well, this is a front drive DCT I'm talking about that we're doing for our partner in China. And so...
But that was one reason not to do it on a Corvette, for example.
The packaging of the 8-speed is super... Somebody mentioned putting it in the same physical space claim as the 6-speed. Mm-hmm. So exciting times in the transmission world and the electrification world as well.
Mm-hmm. Did you have any weight loss with the packaging situation?
Yeah, I think all in all, the 8-speed was a couple of pounds lighter than the 6-speed, and physically in the exact same dimensions.
So you talked about DCT for China. I mean, does that translate that we'll see the DCT here on something?
Well, you know the story of DCTs in North America. The dry clutch DCTs don't really have the same kind of behavior that a normal automatic has. And some of our competitors have found that kind of challenging to get Americans thinking like maybe Europeans or other markets that may be more manual going to automatic. Once you've had the torque converter automatic, you have to really give a customer that. And dry DCT is a tough challenge to replicate that torque converter automatic feel.
Well, you talked earlier about your controls and the things that you were able to do, and with your history at GM. So how, computing power, is that making a huge difference in transmission development?
Well, it's making a huge difference across the board, whether it's computing power in our analysis capability or it's computing power that we put on our cars. It is an amazing revolution in microprocessor technology that's allowed what we thought was not controllable to now be controllable, right. What we thought was not observable through math models that are running in real time to be observable. And the Volt, for example, uses a real-time fuel economy optimizer. It will select how that thing operates in real time, based on the computing power that we put in there to make those decisions. Most of the time you do it offline in a laboratory or in the office, and then you put specific tables in the setup of the computer. We've now gone beyond that to real-time optimization.
Let me ask you one more transmission question, then we're going to talk about Volts and electric. So this is also from the chat room, Terry M. Staskowski, and I may have pronounced your last name incorrectly. Sorry if I did. From GM's perspective, what is the theoretical maximum number of gears that can be used before it becomes counterintuitive or presumably becomes not effective?
Well, CVTs have an infinite number of gears, so...
But you guys don't have CVTs.
We do in the Spark.
Okay.
Today, the Spark here in the U.S. and around the world has a CVT transmission in it. And it's interesting that customers, who buy CVTs, there's a certain characteristic of CVTs that either people like or don't like. And in some cases, we take CVTs and make them emulate a step gear transmission because it's more normal for people as the quote-unquote psychoacoustics that a normal car should have.
So the shift points that we're all used to and don't think about.
Yeah, we put them in there sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But is there a diminishing returns point at which you 12 gears, 13, is 10 about it? Or do you see them going further?
Again, Gary, I would say it depends on spin losses. Doing more is able to cut the fuel economy difference to the theoretical better. And step gear transmissions can carry a lot of torque, great for trailering, great for towing, high torque applications. Where's the limit? The limit is how far we can engineer that cost effectively and efficiency with efficiency. So today we're at 8, 9s, and 10s coming out in the future. Mm-hmm. The mainstay of the production volume, as you know, Stephanie, is 6 speeds. Mm-hmm. And we see the future as a variety of different kinds of technologies, step gear automatics, DCTs, CVTs, we see it all.
And so to the point of the variety, now General Motors has had a variety of electrification approaches and continues to have a variety, not just one flavor.
Right.
So you've had the Volt out there. You've got a new one. We've been teased with that there's a new Volt coming. So
I think there might have been a teaser photo of a rear shot there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, okay. So you've been working on this for a long time.
I have.
And the Volt faithful are committed to Volts. What have you learned from them that you found was important to engineer into the new car to the extent you can talk about it?
Well, man, I would love to talk about this in great detail. I'll have to keep my comments a little bit guarded until January. I think we're going to be unveiling the next-gen Volt at the auto show here in Detroit, and we'll give the full lowdown there. I think we might have some specific media encounters along the way between now and January, so stay tuned for that. I will say that today's Volt is a fantastic vehicle. It's the most loved compact car of any out there for the last 3 years running. Independent surveys, our customers love this car. I love this car. My daughter had a Volt. She loved that car. It's just a terrific change in what is possible with the industry. And I'll give you a few things that we've learned. When you go and buy a Volt or lease a Volt, you can sign up for an anonymous program to have OnStar send data from that car to GM Engineering anonymously to help us understand, you know, driving patterns, what people are doing with the car. Mm-hmm. About 2/3 of the people sign up for it. And that's fantastic because it gives us such a rich, broad amount of data from nearly 50,000 customers all over the country. And what we've learned is a lot of surprising things and pretty exciting things. About 65% of overall driving is electric. If we take back the original proposition of the Volt and say, what were we trying to do? We were trying to, most of the time, the car's electric in most of your driving, and particularly in commuting. And we had this whole idea of most people commute only 40 miles a day, and so we want to try to get that mostly electric. And what we found is that in commuting, about 82% of the energy is coming from the plug and not from the pump. 82% coming from the plug.
So these are people who have plugged in at their house or
yeah,
their place
exactly.
of work or wherever. They
exactly.
plugged in, then they drive, and they're doing it purely on electricity. Yeah,
exactly. 82% of the energy for commuting, through a number of studies we've done, is from the plug. The other thing that we found that we had an idea of, but we now have data on, in fact, the DOE did this study, and it showed that 81% of all trips had no engine start at all. It's a little bit different metric. Don't get them confused. One's energy and one's just trips. But if you think of an environment like California, where most of a car's emissions are made during a cold start, getting rid of 80% of starts is pretty exciting. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting. Some of the other plug-ins that are on the market that aren't a true extended-range EV like the Volt, only less than 10% of trips didn't have an engine start. So the Volt stands out there unique in that area. The drive quality of the Volt, people really love the drive quality of the Volt. The high dynamic response of the torque that comes on. As much as I love transmissions, it doesn't have a downshift. But it has a transmission, and it'll continue to have a transmission going into the future. So the Volt's exciting. We learned a lot from our customers, and we used all of that data to try to look at the next generation Volt and said, for those meaningful things that we think customers really like, the next gen Volt will be better in every way.
Mm-hmm.
Every way.
So, Gary, you worked on electrification for, what, 9 years, I think it was?
I did, yeah. Before on the original EV1 program from 91 till it was gone, basically, mm-hmm. till 2000. And I was development manager, test and development manager at the Proving Grounds, and mm-hmm. I learned a lot. I learned an appreciation of electric vehicles that I still have, except for the obvious disadvantages of range and recharge time and cost of the battery. I'm a huge fan of the extended range electric vehicle concept, so I'm a Volt fan because of that, except for all the added cost.
Yeah,
that's always a challenge. And what I'm wondering, Larry, if I think we all know that the Volt has been a huge customer satisfaction success, highest ever in GM's history and maybe in the industry, or at least one of the highest in the industry. It has not been as great a sales success. It's been somewhat disappointing, I think you would agree. And are there, maybe because of cost, maybe because people don't get it, don't understand it, but are there things on the new one that are going to really help the sales quite a bit, I assume? You won't tell me what, but do you have confidence that what you have done for the next one will really get the sales numbers up further?
Yeah, we're working on that, Gary, in a big way to make sure that the next-gen Volt, the promises made are the promises delivered to our customers. And as we look at what people want in this kind of a vehicle, that we'll deliver on it. We'll hit it out of the park, and people will want this car in the kind of numbers we want to sell. So like I said, we went off into a whole new part of the industry with the Volt. It isn't a BEV. It isn't a hybrid. It's an extended range EV that behaves a lot like an EV. Most of your energy is electric, but you can drive anywhere. Recharging times are not a particular concern for the mission of getting from place to place.
Right.
You've got gasoline stations around the country to do that. Interesting, we've also found that about 60% of Volt customers only charge on 110.
Yeah.
We thought it'd be opposite. We thought 80% of the customers would want 220 charging. Faster charging, it's got to be better, right? Well, it turns out that a lot of customers spend the times with their cars at home, and we've done a lot of studies on where are cars when they're not being driven. It's kind of an interesting plot. Mm-hmm. Day by day, every day of the week, we can see where cars are, and they're home a lot more than I even thought about. Mm-hmm. But half of the vehicles are home at any one time, period.
And when they're home, they're mostly plugged in. So,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. And it's overnight, so it doesn't matter how long
so,
it takes.
So 8-hour charge is perfectly acceptable for the majority of these customers.
I see that, as Gary points out, the satisfaction has been really high, but how do you get more conquest? How do you convince more people to understand and teach them about this technology such that they'll accept it or try it? Because it doesn't seem to be an issue of people being happy with it once they have it.
Right.
But there still is a concern or a reaction with people not apparently understanding all of the benefits and or not being willing to take it that extra step. I mean, where are you?
We're definitely going to learn from what we've done in Volt 1 and do more in Volt 2 to help customers understand the proposition. You're absolutely right, Stephanie. Mm-hmm. If you give a customer a Volt for 2 weeks, they get it.
Mm-hmm.
They get it. Like, I've gone this far and I don't tank is still full. And most Volt customers go nearly 1,000 miles before filling their tank. A family member of ours has a Volt, and I talked to him just before the show. 10,000 miles on the car, 33 gallons.
Wow.
10,000 miles on the car, 33 gallons of fuel used. So give it off to Doug Bortz. Doug did a fantastic job driving that Volt.
So we have this. I always mix this one up. JM1NB, where's the best place to run an electric motor in an electric hybrid setup? At the wheels, transmission, integrated with the transmission, somewhere else? What have you guys found?
Well, this is the big challenge. Now I've got an engine and I've got a transmission and a drivetrain, and I want to take an electric motor and stick it in there somewhere. Where do you put it? It's a really, really good question. And to some extent, it depends on what the mission is. You know, if the mission is to be an electric car, then you don't need the engine, and the motor is it, and you just have a really simple single-speed type transmission, like the Spark EV is. One large motor, simple gear reduction, and that's the proposition of Spark EV, which is terrific. It's 80% efficient in getting battery power to the wheels on the city, and 92% efficient on the highway and on the US06 test, which is kind of a higher speed highway kind of test. So in a case of a BEV, we kind of know pretty clearly what to do. Now, I'm going to add it to a combustion engine vehicle. There's no one exact formula that is, this is the right place, put it there. E-Assist is a mild hybrid, and we put it on the engine accessory drive. It physically takes the place of the alternator. In some cases, you look at, where do I have room to put this motor to start with? So taking off an alternator and putting on a E-Assist motor generator that can now drive the accessory drive both ways in terms of torque, delivering torque and generating torque, generating power. Put it on the accessory drive. That's one place to put it. You can certainly put it in a number of different places. The Prius, the most popular hybrid, has two electric motors, and it makes up, basically, with gearing, the transmission. And so the objective there is to get an electric CVT that also provides electric driving and can start and stop the engine and manage torque that way. It's a pretty good formula. It's working very well. It's the same formula Ford has. Some other companies put it between the engine and the transmission. They could put it directly in the middle or have a clutch that can disconnect the engine and just have the motor drive the transmission, if you think of it that way. Others have put it on the non-driven axis. So you have the normal powertrain up front in a front-wheel drive car and another motor in the rear for quote-unquote electric all-wheel drive. So it depends on what you want and depends on what the mission is. I would say for the most fuel efficiency, this so-called two-motor type system seems to work pretty good. Honda tried the one motor, the IMA, for many years, many attempts. They've gone to a two-motor type system as well.
Between the engine and the transmission.
It's actually the transmission is the two motors and gearing is inside the transmission.
What do you mean for the IMA?
The IMA was between them.
Right.
Right. And it really didn't work out so well.
Mm-hmm.
Never got good enough fuel economy, good enough performance to really be meaningful. And so they went to a two-motor system. The Volt is a two-motor system. Prius.
Hyundai.
I don't know what Hyundai's is doing exactly. Some of them have a single motor and then have this belt alternator starter as a second motor as well to get a smooth engine start.
And back to consumer education, I mean, as we talk about all the different places you can put these motors and all the different ways solutions you can have, somehow a consumer has to process that in such a way that they can understand what it is they're buying.
Why?
They only need to know the numbers, how fuel efficient is it.
Yeah, people understand 6-speed, 8-speed, 10-speed transmission. They think about
it.
At least think about that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's difficult to say that it's an electrified vehicle. It's a hybrid vehicle.
Right.
The best way that we've been known to do it is just, this is the fuel economy, and this is the dollar saved. And people probably get the dollar saved even more than the miles per gallon, because
right.
that's what they're really going to save.
That's the proposition. That gets them into considering it.
Mm. Yeah.
But once you're living with it and understanding it and convincing them to spend more money on it, because it costs more money
right.
to get you're getting the savings
yeah.
at the end, but it costs more money to do it and to get over some of the hesitation to it.
And Stephanie, you're right. The Volt label mm-hmm. does not describe to a customer at all what they're getting into. It doesn't. It was never really intended for this kind of a vehicle. It describes what it can do under circumstance A and circumstance B. It tells you how long EV miles you have,
mm-hmm.
35, 38. and it tells you fuel economy when the engine's on. It doesn't tell you heuristically, oh yeah, and every time I plug in, I get more of those EV miles.
Right.
And I'm plugging in 10 times a week, which an average Volt customer plugs in like 10 times a week.
Mm-hmm.
Not 7, 10. That surprised us. We didn't.
Yeah.
We kind of figured a once-a-day charge. And you think about all these cars are ending up home more of the time, and they're getting more than one charge a day.
Mm-hmm.
So the label doesn't do the job. You're right, Stephanie. I wish that we had a simple formula to explain it to customers. Dollar saved is probably the best one that we have, but it still doesn't describe the full benefit.
We've had the I've not driven the Volt recently, but I drove the ELR, and one of the things that I noticed in there was watching the fuel gauge go down and watching the electric miles and seeing how all of that interplayed and interchanged. And that's something consumers do have to understand, because it does behave much more differently than what they expect from their regular car. Not badly, it works really well. It's a very neat system. But that's, you get in and you spend a week with it, and it does something different than what you're expecting. And I think we still have a communication and an education challenge with that to get people to understand what's really happening.
I'm going to need to get Kevin to work on that. We have a phone call from somebody on the outside, maybe a real consumer. So, Ben?
Hi, this is Ryan from Overland Park, Kansas. My question today is, does GM see the advancing hybridization of performance drivetrains, like in LaFerrari, the car from Ferrari, in their lineup in the future, perhaps for some sort of high-performance Corvette, or even in more potentially mundane offerings, like in some Cadillacs or Buicks, much like Volvo is doing with their new XC90 T8. Also, I was wondering, does GM see any need to go with electric turbocharging as a way of combining the benefits of a supercharger and a turbocharger into one type of unit, as opposed to having to do a twin piping like some Volkswagens have passed and the new also Volvo XC90. Thanks. Bye.
Well, those are very rich questions that deserve an hour or two of answer, and most of which I couldn't tell you. But I can't talk about our future products. I'm sorry about that. But I will say that these electrified vehicles are arguably 3% of the market. So we're just starting. The need for fuel efficiency is, we don't see it ending. We see it continuing to grow, not just here, but around the world. Irrespective of the fact that will we have a lot of oil available or not, I think we talked to some oil company leaders not so long ago, and you know, they led me to believe that it wasn't a matter of is there enough oil, but rather is there enough atmosphere to take the CO2 that that we're delivering to it. So I think the electrification of the automobile as a way of getting better fuel economy will continue to grow. It'll take time. It's not going to happen overnight. It'll come in various forms. It could come in the forms of battery electric cars, hybrids, electric turbos. That's a pretty interesting proposition. There's a lot of folks talking about that. Just how that benefits the cars, you can put your mind to and try to think about. But we're going to see more electric motors on cars for both accessories and traction over many, many years to come.
Okay. Well, with that, we asked you for a half hour of your time. You gave us more than a half hour of your time. And we'll have to get you back when we can talk about this new Volt
that will
be coming out.
I'd love to.
And maybe spend an hour talking about these other subjects of electrification. So Larry Nitz, Executive Director of Global Transmissions and Electrification from General Motors, thank you very much for your time.
Thanks for having me here. And, really appreciate it.
And we're going to go to a break.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
And we're back, and presumably this time you can hear me, as there were some issues earlier. So, okay, let's talk about what's been going on news-wise. The big news, I think, one of the things, Kia announcing that they're going to spend $1 billion on building a plant in Mexico. What do you guys make of that?
Well, it's not a surprise, because who isn't? Who doesn't have one, or who isn't going to have one, for all the obvious reasons?
Then what are the obvious reasons?
Well, it's North America, and yet it's much less expensive. Labor-wise, and so on. I'm not an expert in that area, but it seems to me that's just labor kind of the norm.
And it's not just labor cost; it's the fact that it's a skilled workforce.
Yeah.
For the most part, they've got workforce down there that that is skilled with automotive trades and that. So it's not just less expensive; it's also skilled.
So we got Honda building Fitz down there. We're going to have Daimler working with
Infiniti
mm-hmm. on what are they going to build down there?
The Q30 and the CLA and the GLA.
Mm-hmm.
And engines too, aren't they?
Yeah, I believe there's engines in there as
and
well.
There's those big Nissan plants down there.
Yeah, and
shipping costs would be reasonable compared to other lower labor cost markets.
Mm-hmm.
And Mexico has a phenomenal number of free trade agreements as well. So they've got, I think, 40 or 45.
So with other countries.
With other countries. So it's much easier to export out of Mexico than it is out of the United States. And, you know, there's a lot of the vehicles that are going in the new plants are B and C segment vehicles where profit margin and cost is much more an issue than, for example, a full-size SUV, right?
So in other words, you could keep the full-size SUVs in the U.S. market,
perhaps.
And you would make the cars that you have less margin on there.
All right. Where you've got not only a less expensive labor force, as we talked about, but you have the ability to send that product not just to the United States, but also to South America. There's better export agreements with Europe and with Canada and several other places. So in doing so, they can balance it out. There's not much that's being built there that is only going to be built there from one of the new plants that are coming online. Even, Kia's new plant, we expect it to be Forte. Kia's not going to suddenly stop building it anywhere else and only build it there. Fit still has production in other places, I believe. Q5 is going to be specific.
Right, Audi's going to have its
Audi's
plant
going to be
down
only
there.
Coming out of Mexico, but part of the reason they chose Mexico is because Mexico does have free trade agreements with Europe. And that made it viable and feasible where building in the United States would not have.
So if they put the plant in the U.S., Audi, they would have to pay tariffs to send the vehicles to
back to Europe. Yeah.
So not necessarily a good thing. And then to your point about labor costs, there's a story in the L.A. Times earlier this year that says the Center for Automotive Research says that Mexican auto workers earn about $8 an hour versus an average of $37 an hour in the United States. So,
And labor cost is only, 5% or so of the cost of the vehicle, but it does add up. It becomes significant as the volume of the vehicles increases, obviously. Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, people, they've been building cars in Mexico since, mid-60s? Or so it's not a new market to automotive production. It's growing out because it can export. In North America, both in the United States and in Mexico and Canada, is becoming a larger export market for production as well. Some of the increases that we're seeing even in the U.S. and in Canada is going to be for export volume.
Seems to me Mexico has been very smart in how they have passed their laws in order to make themselves a very desirable place to make vehicles and other things.
In contrast to Brazil, where most of Brazil and Argentina, but more Brazil, their rules and laws are set up to encourage in automotive production and R&D development within Brazil, but they want it to stay there.
Right.
Mexico's been really aggressive in giving these free trade agreements, saying, come build here and send it wherever you want, but do the production here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was also another thing today, the launch of Mustang in Flat Rock.
Production launch.
So they're making Mustangs in that plant, and they're making Fusions in that plant. So what do we think? We think that we're going to have more Mustangs and fewer Fusions, or same amount of Fusions and just additional Mustangs. What do you guys? What do you guys think?
Initially, they're going to have a challenge because right, there's going to be high demand for both. Trying to make that balance work is going to be very challenging, at least near term.
When looking at some of our sales forecast numbers, the Mustang is still, we're looking at 87-88% United States volume.
Right.
So the global volume is going to be very slow to ramp up in terms of sales.
For
the Mustang.
For the Mustang.
But you know, it's interesting. One include the other? Are they on different lines, or does
they can,
do you have to reduce Fusion to get more Mustangs or not?
There's the capacity. Yeah, you would have to flex between them. Yeah. My understanding is that the lines have gotten so that they can run either car.
But it was interesting,
through the body shop.
Talking, you know, we were talking earlier about the Corvette, and we learned last week that the sales of Corvette far exceeded the expectations that they had originally planned for.
For the first year.
And they were saying something like 36,000 units, and they had been used to selling 1,000 a month. So they didn't have shutdown, they didn't go on vacation, they were just building Stingrays.
Well, old car versus new car, and people have been waiting for this new one. And then when they started reading and hearing how good it was, the floodgates opened, so to speak.
Yeah. And Mustang and Fusion, the Flat Rock plant, too, is right now two-shift. So they have the ability to go to three-shift.
They had a third,
I was a little surprised they didn't bring MKZ up there, which is being built in Mexico, and as we recall, that was a slow launch because of the problems they were having with those cars, and they sent them to Flat Rock and had them quarantined in Flat Rock.
But how would they fit that in between Fusions and Mustangs?
That's a very good question.
I think it's fine where it is.
You think it's fine, yeah?
Yeah. It's much lower volume, obviously.
It's much lower volume. Mm-hmm. Well, they'll start shipping some of those to China as well.
Yeah, that's right, yes.
Shipping the Mustangs to China.
MKZ.
MKZs, because Lincoln is going big time into China. Seriously is what I mean by big time. Mm-hmm. Serious effort in China. Mm-hmm.
Serious effort. Yeah.
So speaking of China, I mean, they've been having these antitrust suits against Western automakers. I mean, Europeans, General Motors, on and on and on. And then now India's gotten in the act where they've been charging suppliers with antitrust about cost of parts. What's going on? Is this, you know, everybody seemed to be rushing over there and it's just going to be all sweetness and light. We're going to sell all these cars. And now they just, the Chinese and now the Indians seem to be being off-putting.
It might be that there were rules in place that weren't necessarily followed because there was the encouragement within China sometimes, you know, we'll just do it this way and kind of expedite it and get it done. And some things may or may not have really been by the rules as much as, and they've clearly decided to look into that. You know, when you hear the first couple of reports, there's a lot of comment saying, well, it's some sort of semi-attack against the foreign manufacturers. But with the volume and the number of manufacturers they're looking at, there seems to be something going on.
As long as they don't decide to nationalize everything.
Is it a realistic fear, do you think?
Would I put it past them? No, I would not. Realistically, that's happened before. You say, guess what? Your whole plant and everything now belongs to us. Mm-hmm. You guys go on home. We'll take care of it from here on. Mm-hmm. I think that's the reason. I don't know this, but I suspect that's the reason that General Motors was one of the few initially that went in there. They were willing to take that risk, and others were much slower until they saw what was going on and the success GM was having, and now they're investing more. But there's always that risk.
The risk does seem to be somewhat reduced at this point. I mean, it is, because you know the government is much stronger there and determines a lot about the economics, and it's not as a free market. But it doesn't seem as likely as it had been at one point 10 years ago, maybe. I mean, you know, it remains a possibility. But at this point, one thing kind of siding against that, I guess, is that the Chinese consumers do enjoy buying foreign brands.
Yeah.
And that does, you know, it's difficult to nationalize a product and then say keep sending it over.
As long as
they couldn't just like add a vowel to the end of Audi and so it'd have two I's on the end.
You know, they notice that.
And no. I mean, but if they took over. Yeah. So you would still sort of have the foreign cachet, but it'd be...
But it doesn't work.
See, but, you know...
The consumers are smart enough to notice the difference.
You know, but I caught something. There was a Reuters report, and this is, you know, non-automotive, but it just got me to thinking that apparently the Satya Nadella, who is the new head of Microsoft, has to go over to China because Chinese officials have accused the Windows operating system and Office software of violating anti-monopoly laws. Okay, so Microsoft has to go over there violating anti-monopoly laws, and Windows 8 has been forbidden at state-run companies in China because they claimed that it was collecting all kinds of information, sending it back to Redmond, and not to the NSA, to Redmond to take care of this. And so the guy who runs Microsoft have to go there and say, you know, Windows is okay. I mean, yeah. You know, please use this. And so I don't know that I'm quite so sanguine as you are in terms of the sweetness and light of the.
I'm not saying it's sweetness and light. China, I don't think that
they'll
we're
do whatever immediate. They feel.
And I would say with the trade and the issues that we were talking about earlier with the cases that are coming, it's not just the automotive companies because there have been some,
right.
some situations with I think some computer companies as well.
Right.
So it's not even one industry they're looking at.
It seems to me status quo is fine as long as it's a win-win for everybody. If they felt it was in their best interests to do something, they would probably not hesitate to do it.
I do agree with that.
And, now, everybody is winning from that arrangement, but someday they may say, you know what, we'll do better if we just kick out the foreigners.
And the question, part of that would be, is how they're defining better.
Yeah.
And how we define better.
Right.
Is it profitability? Is it job? There's a bunch of different metrics. You can choose a bazillion of them. And whether their metric of better and improvement and winning is in alignment with what the other automakers want to do, that's where the gray area could be.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I don't doubt China's will to be able to do that if they chose to.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Speaking of things coming back, the Cadillac SRX is going to go to Spring Hill.
Right.
General Motors announced this week. So, what do you guys take? What's your take on that?
There's a whole cascade of things happening with the production of those vehicles. So we've got Equinox and Terrain moving to what we think is a global Delta platform, and their production is shifting, and Cadillac shifting to a different platform as well that'll come out of Spring Hill. With the Acadia to follow, and then
okay, but the Equinox is built in Canada, right?
It's going to go down to Mexico as well, from what I understand.
So
all of them, 100%.
All of them. That's my understanding.
And Acadia.
Acadia is going to Spring Hill. No,
Terrain.
there will still be some Equinox and Ingersoll though, but not in Nashua.
Okay.
So there's a whole that is from what we understand that is one move that is really following several others with those vehicles.
Is that just the way they're deciding to balance capacity, or is it let's take some cost out of it for reasons we discussed earlier?
I think it's balancing capacity and a whole lot of things.
The whole Oshawa thing was just they found they needed additional capacity because there was such a great demand for the Equinox out of Ingersoll.
And so was Spring Hill. Spring Hill was Equinox went to Spring Hill because they were running.
Right. And isn't that an interesting story? So we had Spring Hill. They shut it down post Saturn, and now they've had to bring it back, and they're building engines there, and they announced a new.
Well, they were building engines there before.
Yeah, they were.
The Saturn engines.
So they closed down the. Yeah. But I mean, they closed down the facility, right?
They did.
I mean, it was shuttered, and then they brought engine production there.
Engine first, and then Equinox.
And then. Equinox there, and now they're going to be, you know, adding another engine there.
But I think there was always a lot of internal discussion about that's such a great facility. Why would we not continue to use it or go back to using it? And, and I kind of always expected they would, and here they are. It's a great place to build cars for a lot of reasons.
Engines. It's the cyclical nature of the industry, too.
And I don't know whether they made the decision to close it or the government task force made the decision, told them to close it. When all that was going on, which brands do you shut down? Which plants do you shut down? You know, who knows?
Yeah, I don't know what the answer is to that question is.
Oh. Well, this has been going so well, didn't even notice. It's time for another break.
Wow.
So, Ben, please take it away.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play, just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
Okay, and we're back. You know, we've been talking about macro issues in terms of the industry. Let's deep dive in a little bit here to some product-related questions. And so the Acura TLX, their big hope for getting a sporty sedan that will resonate with the market in the way that some of its previous products haven't. So, Gary, you just were driving it yesterday. Stephanie, you drove it a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So let's get your impressions.
Great, a product question. I love it. I've not been a huge fan of Acura sedans in recent years for a number of reasons, beginning with the front-end styling, but there were lots of other issues. I mean, it looks like a giant potato peeler or something in the front.
Ah.
But they've toned that down. It looks much better. The whole car looks very good from a proportion standpoint and the styling. But more important than that, they've really done a great job of replacing a slightly larger car and a somewhat smaller car with one that fits the gap nicely, fills the gap between the ILX and the RLX. So now they have a three sedan logical progression. But I think we were all very impressed with the way the thing drove, both dynamically on some very curvy and sometimes rough roads and driving it fairly aggressively, and yet the ride is good. Two engines, a V6 and a 4, 2.4-liter 4, outstanding. One's got an 8-speed automatic, one's got a 9-speed automatic, getting back to what we were talking about.
Right.
And I was so impressed with the 4 in terms of its output that my thought is, why would you need a V6?
Mm-hmm.
And it does the four-wheel steer thing, the power all-wheel steer.
Power all-wheel steer.
Pause. But it really works. It's very subtle. You don't notice it working. You just notice how well it works and how mm-hmm. good, how well the thing handles. And that is on the two-wheel drive, front-wheel drive car. Then it has I always thought was one of the nuttiest acronyms ever, the super handling all-wheel drive. But now it's a new version of that mm-hmm. that's lighter, smaller, less costly, less losses, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's the reason to buy the V6 is because you can't get that with the 4 yet. But that's also an outstanding. So bottom line is, it could be a turning point for them in the sedan market. They've not been doing well in sedans. So pretty well in their crossovers, but not the sedans.
Yeah.
This could turn it around for them.
What do you think, Steph?
I would agree. I think the size issue, too, is really nice because it's not just that it's logical, but it is a good size for a family. It's a good size to drive. It's
mm-hmm.
a good in-betweener. And, I mean, I agree, power and handling-wise, there's no reason to take mm-hmm. the 6 over the 4. The one reason I would say is that the 6 was a little quieter, a little bit more refined, and the all-wheel drive setup. So that comes down to more choice. And, of course, the four-cylinder is more likely to be the volume engine mm-hmm. in this kind of a lineup anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But they did a really nice job with the styling on the car. The interior I liked a lot better. They've kind of got a grip on managing the number of buttons mm-hmm. that Acura has, because there have been Acuras where I think we counted about 56 one day. it was a little overwhelming at some points, and that's toned down quite a bit.
It's a pretty nice balance of touchscreen and buttons with a non-touchscreen up above.
I'm still not sold on the two screens, but they've made it work pretty well.
I just got out of a Civic with the two screens, and I sort of liked it, but I wondered, why do you need a tachometer in a Civic? I didn't understand that, the big tach, but no. To the point of buttons.
That of a lot of cars.
But, I mean, to the point of buttons, I mean, one of the things that disturbed me about the Civic, I mean, it's like one of the only things that disturbed me about the car is in terms of the interface, that if you wanted to turn the volume on the radio, and, you know, those of a certain age, we all like knobs, and you just have to touch.
Yeah.
But then again, you know, if I have an iPad, there's no knobs, and I'm
just
completely familiar with it. I can figure that out, but I'm just on a car. I had a problem with that. But so another thing, Gary, you and I were just in Virginia earlier this week, and we drove the Volkswagen lineup, and I think notably the e-Golf, sort of keeping with our e-theme this evening. I was quite impressed with that car. I think that the electric version of the Golf is just really an outstanding execution.
I drove the e-Golf Euro version back when they did the Golf introduction launch.
As did I.
In California. Mm-hmm. And I spent a lot of time with it, and I was pretty well impressed. Again, I like e-cars in general, and this is a good execution of it. I did not, regretfully, get around to driving the e-Golf American.
Oh.
This because I focused on Jetta, which is their best-selling car and also very substantially improved.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I'm going to be reviewing that one, so I had to spend more time with that.
Mm-hmm.
But does the e-Golf American spec differ much from the Euro spec if you've driven them both?
No. I
like that they have an adjustable regen thing. So you can say, I want a lot of regen, so I don't have to use the brake much, and it puts more energy back
more
in the battery.
Back, so you can...
Or I can use less, which is less annoying to me to have a smoother.
Yeah, and they actually have three settings on it. So one is basically normal, and then you have it's like Echo, and then you have Echo Plus. And the thing is, when you go into Echo Plus, there's an announcement on the screen that says, you know, your performance will be severely degraded and your climate system will not work. You know what I mean? Oh. It's just like, wow, great. I think I'll use that. You know what I mean? There's nothing like driving around and be like, please, car, go.
Yep. And please, car, cool. That's a choice you make. You want range or you want air conditioning.
Right. But still, it's an interesting car and... they're doing some interesting things. So, from James S. Welling in the chat room, where and when do you, Stephanie, think we'll first be able to ride a fully autonomous car? And you can chime in.
Oh, boy. Boy. I think we've said 2025 before we've got any on the road, but it's still a long haul from there, even when you get something. We still have a lot of questions in terms of insurance, in terms of liability, and even with Google's test car, they had wanted to do the test with no steering and brake, and California has pushed back and said, okay, wait, we're trying to be really aggressive on this, but you're going a little farther than we want just yet. So they have to kind of change their test process a little bit.
Well, yeah, so California just came out with a new ruling that's saying that all cars have to have a steering wheel and a brake.
Autonomous.
But it's all cars.
It's all cars. Yeah.
So that would include autonomous cars.
Yeah, I think that they're not the only state or country to have that rule. But it's still a lot out there. What we are seeing is a lot more application of the systems that are enabling autonomous. I mean, we had drove the Mercedes S550 a couple of weeks ago, and it's pretty impressive how smoothly the lane keeping assist and the direct steering.
Mm-hmm.
Kristen's going to get mad at me for not saying it right, but the anachronism for that. But the system works really well. I decided to see what the whole commuter traffic would be like, and for a few miles, just didn't touch the gas or the brake, and you have this really gentle hold on the steering wheel. If you let go of the steering wheel, it gives you a light and says, I don't know
drive
how
your,
it's telling.
Just drive your car.
I don't know what sensor it was using to know that I had my hands on the steering wheel, but it did. But I felt that situation really made for a less exhausting sort of stop and go driving situation. It wasn't so much that you could just say, forget it, I'm not going to pay attention to driving the car, but it took a little bit of the stress out of the whole situation.
Gary, I bet you like to drive your cars.
I have very mixed feelings on this whole thing. I like to drive. On the other hand, I've come around to saying semi-autonomous could be good for exactly what you're talking about.
Commuting sucks.
Creeping along in traffic jams. As our friend Jim Hall once said, I'd love it if I had a car that you could pull up to the mall, it would let you out and go park itself. And then you call it, and it comes, picks you up again. Those things would be good. On the other hand, I think the major objective of a lot of people is to take the driver out of the equation, and the cars can't hit each other, so you have crash-proof cars. But has there yet been a crash-proof computer? I mean, do I want to turn over my life to the reliability of not only the system in my car, but everyone else's car, and read the newspaper and just assume that it's going to be all good? I don't think so.
Well,
which is why
drivers are fallible, computers are fallible, everything is fallible, and maybe our phone system will not be fallible this time. We have a call.
My name is Clem Zarovsky, Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, who is doing the best, smartest deal? Ford with their all-aluminum pickup, or Ram just putting a diesel engine in their steel pickup and achieving high mileage? Thank you very much.
Okay, so that was interesting. The Consumer Reports came out and said the Ram 1500 Eco Diesel was, as of right now, the best full-size pickup on the market.
For fuel economy.
Well, they just said basically overall this is the best thing. But the interesting aspect is that they don't take price into account when they make that calculation.
The other interesting aspect is I haven't seen the numbers, but I've been told that there is a 1-point difference among the three. So Rams here, right. Yeah, 26
you know
points
what?
And 4
Gary,
to 25
on.
And
come
whatever.
On. If you finish first, you won.
You won.
If you finish third, you might as well not have.
They're all good.
Right.
The domestic pickups are all great these days. To the gentleman's question, I think we don't know yet. The jury's out on the F-150.
Yeah.
Ultimately, that might be the better risk to take, and it is a huge risk, but it may pay off, and maybe everybody will have to go that direction to get there for CAFE.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the thing. It's a long-term game here. Yeah. I mean, the decision between aluminum right now and diesel on the Ram addresses the next couple of years. Really, the harder work is going to be for.
Why
future.
Would you not do both?
Why would, yeah.
Ultimately,
well,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Aluminum is adding to the price of your truck. Diesel is adding to the price of your truck, and so combining the two things is it's enormous. I mean, it's always been the question of why not have hybrid diesels?
Oh yeah, but CAFE doesn't care about price if that's what you have to do.
Right.
But
you have
care
to
about
do
price.
It,
consumers
and then at some point price. The consumer says, "I'm not mm-hmm. going to buy that; it's too expensive." But that CAFE doesn't care at this point.
All right, so we're going to end the show. Anything you want to talk about before we leave?
I think we've hit quite a few things today.
Okay.
I think that
August sales up or down?
Up. I think we're about 16.5 SAAR for
16.5.
August. Is what we're thinking.
All right.
Could be a little bit. For the year, we're at 16.3 million, which means the second half of 2014 is going to be stronger than the first.
Okay. Do you agree?
Yes. And if I can open another subject quickly?
Quickly.
I'll be very interested to see what they've done with this Volt, getting back to electrification for a minute, because do you want to have more battery for more electric range, or do you want to have less battery for less weight and cost at the expense of some electric range? And will the battery be that much better that you could trade off between the two? That's the big question mm-hmm. to me. Does anybody care if you get 30 miles versus 35 if the thing costs $5,000 less?
Right.
Right. Got to convince more people to try it, too.
I'm guessing they'll go for a less battery, and the battery chemistry will be improved, so you might get an even trade of mm-hmm. the same range on electric, all EV range, with less cost and less battery if they've been able to improve the battery.
So I'm betting on all those chemists that are out there are going to invent these things, and they just ought to weld shut the front so consumers don't need to worry about it, and it'll all be good. So, okay. Stephanie Brindley, IHS, thank you very much for being here this evening.
Thanks for inviting me. It's been fun.
And I always find that when I write IHS on my computer that Microsoft turns it to HIS.
It's finally trained.
Yeah, I can't make that happen. Gary Witzenberg, automedia.com. It's always good to have a guy who knows product the way you do. And
thank you.
And I think it's been great. And so people can find you where?
Automedia.com and other places. I write for a lot of different outlets, magazines like Motor Trend and Ward's and various other websites.
IHS.com?
IHS. Yeah.
Okay, and my stuff's at AutoFieldGuide.com. So, friend AutoLine at Facebook.com/AutoLineNetwork. So it's AutoLine Network, all one big word. Follow AutoLine on Twitter at Twitter.com/AutoLine. Thanks to Larry Nitz for being here earlier, and he's obviously not here now. And thank you for watching the show, and we'll see you all here next week. Thank you. Good night.
Night.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.